Okay, thank you for having me here. I do want to just acknowledge my co-authors in this paper, Dr. Kate LePan from the University of Massachusetts and Dr. Saba Masho from Virginia Commonwealth University. So I have nothing to disclose. In talking about unintended pregnancies, I assume that this is a population that is pretty familiar with this problem, so I'll try to go through this briefly. There are about 3.1 million unintended pregnancies in the United States every year, which is about 50% of total pregnancies. Every time I hear that number, it's sort of astonishing to me that here in 2013, we have a problem that is so big that it seems academically ought to be easier to control. We know that women who are low income, who have low educational attainment, or who are of minority race or ethnicity are more likely to experience unintended pregnancies. About 50% of unintended pregnancies are attributable to either inconsistent use of contraceptives or non-use of contraceptives. And in other studies, we found that about 10% of women who say that they are sexually active and not trying to have a pregnancy, not trying to conceive, are not using any type of method at all. And there's an additional percentage of women who are using less than ideal methods. Low-income women in particular are more likely to experience gaps in their contraceptive use and to use less effective methods such as the condom as opposed to prescription or hormonal methods. One thing that I think has gotten a little bit less attention is that we have this huge number of women, 15% of women who are using contraceptives at least sporadically, but in a 12-month period, 15% of them will experience at least a one-month gap. So this is somewhat underestimating the problem of access to contraceptives because this is saying they went an entire month without using anything, whereas we know in addition to that we have women who are inconsistently using their other methods. So publicly funded family planning is a big deal. There are 36.2 million women in the United States who are at risk for unintended pregnancy, and of these about half are in need of publicly funded services. So this means that their income levels or other sort of indicators that put them, that make them eligible for public assistance are there. So 48% of these at-risk women need some sort of public funding to help them take care of their family planning needs. Of the available publicly funded family planning services, most of them are Medicaid. It's over 70%. So Medicaid family planning waivers were established, the first in 1993, to help us begin addressing this problem of unintended pregnancies, especially among low-income women. So these waivers come in two different types. They are either income-based or what we'll call losing coverage. So the income-based extends family planning services only to women who would otherwise not qualify for Medicaid, but can now get family planning services up to, it's usually between 185% and 200% of the federal poverty level. So they're not getting other Medicaid services, but they can get their routine gynecologic care and contraceptive services. The losing coverage waivers are much less inclusive. They are aimed at women who are losing their Medicaid coverage for one reason or another. Typically, these are women who were enrolled in Medicaid for their pregnancy, and then at the end of their pregnancy or the period Medicaid will cover for some period after the pregnancy, when that period ends, they get this extension of just their family planning coverage. So the first waiver was approved in 1993 for South Carolina, and since then, about half of the United States have implemented some sort of waiver. Most of them are these income-based, and some states now cover much higher than the 200%. But there are also several states that use this losing coverage. The reason that this is somewhat relevant today is that the Affordable Care Act, which we know is still, I'm not sure, entirely hammered out, allows states to permanently amend their Medicaid plans so that they don't have to reapply for these waivers every 3 to 5 years. They are able to make a change in their Medicaid plan that says, from now on until we make another permanent change in our Medicaid plan, that we are going to cover women with family planning services. So our research question for this was, are these waivers associated with an increased use of more effective contraceptive methods in the population of low-income uninsured women? We anticipated that women who lived in states that had one of these waivers, who were low-income women, that they would have a higher rate of contraceptive use, and not just any use, but that they would be more likely to rely on the prescription methods or long-term reversible methods that we thought were more ideal for most women. So we used a cross-sectional data from using the 1995 National Survey of Family Growth and also the 2006-2010 National Survey of Family Growth. We linked this with the National Survey of Family Growth contextual file, which is census data and other things to give us some contextual factors about the states in which these women lived. And then we used state-level policy information from the Guttmacher Institute. So this was essentially just data that told us whether the state had an income-based waiver, a losing coverage waiver, or nothing at all. And this was linked at the Research Data Center for the National Center for Health Statistics. We ended up with 1,736 low-income women, 21 years of age or older, who did not have any private insurance and were not planning a pregnancy. We used the low-income cutoff of less than or equal to 185% of the federal poverty level. This is somewhat conservative. As I said, some of these waivers do cover up to 200% and some even beyond that now. But at this time, the most common, our data started to be collected in 2006, 185% covered the majority of states where there was an income waiver. So we looked at contraceptive use in the month of interviews. So women were asked, are you using any kind of method to prevent pregnancy? And if you are, what is it? They were able to choose from a list, and we had five possible options. Or we collapsed them into five possible options. So female sterilization, prescription methods that are covered by Medicaid, over-the-counter methods covered by Medicaid. Medicaid often covers condoms and diaphragms and cervical caps and spermicide and things like that. Methods not covered by Medicaid, and this is primarily your natural family planning methods, and then no contraceptive method. Our determinant was whether or not the state that these women lived in had a Medicaid family planning waiver, and we classified states as either having an income-based waiver, which we thought would be the most inclusive, a losing coverage waiver, or no waiver at all. And then we controlled for a variety of demographic confounders, including age at interview, race, ethnicity, education, marital status, and their insurance status, their age at first intercourse, the number of lifetime sexual partners, their pregnancy intention, whether they had ever been pregnant, and whether they had ever had an abortion. So the women included in our logistic regression model in our 17,000 were all women who said they were intending a future pregnancy. Okay, so we also wanted to think about the contextual factors that could be influencing this. We thought that it was possible that there were underlying differences between the states, where states that passed waivers or passed different types of waivers may just differ fundamentally at the political level or the demographic level. So we controlled for the percentage of the county that was black race or Hispanic ethnicity, the 2005 county per capita income, the 2004 crime rate, and the 2005 county unemployment rate, the Gini index, which is an index of income inequality, and then the 1995 state contraceptive prevalence. We thought that this would be one of the more important confounders. If states had underlying differences in the prevalence of women who used contraceptives, we thought this would be a big predictor or a big confounder in our model if we didn't adjust for it. So we used Sudan with the NSFG sample weights and polygamous logistic regression. So it was polygamous logistic regression because we had the five-level outcome. And a change in estimate strategy for the modeling. So we added variables into the model one at a time to determine if they altered the relationship between having a waiver and contraceptive use by 10% or more, they were retained in the model as a potential confounder. Otherwise, they were excluded. So we had 54% of our sample lived in a state that had some type of waiver. So about half of the low-income women in the National Survey of Family Growth lived in a state that had some waiver. And I think we would anticipate this since about half the states have a waiver of some type. 39% were income-based and 15% losing coverage. And overall, we had 10% of women who reported that they were not using any kind of contraceptive method. So this is consistent with what we've seen in other studies. there were not a lot of differences, individual level differences among women by the state's Medicaid family planning status. They, if you lived in a state that was income-based, you were a little bit more likely to be younger, so you had a higher percentage of women that were 21 to 24. 43% of women in income-based expansion states had less than high school education, compared to 34% in no-waiver states. And again, remember, this is low-income women. They were a little bit more likely to be Hispanic, and they had a slightly higher number of women reporting their first intercourse at less than 15 years of age. So this is where you get to the really disappointing part. We found that if you look at our logistic regression, you can see that all of our confidence intervals include unity. So from this study, we did not identify any population level effect resulting from Medicaid family planning waivers. And honestly, this surprised us. We had done previous research looking at the impact of insurance mandates. So for privately insured women, if they lived in a state that had a mandate that said if you have insurance, your insurance company has to cover prescriptions, contraceptives, and we found a fairly big effect, about 70% more likely to use contraceptives, and we honestly expected that we would see something similar here. And that does not seem to be the case. So we wanted to think about what does the previous research out there say. So in general, overwhelmingly, the research says that women who access Medicaid-funded family planning services are more likely to use any type of contraceptive method, and they're more likely to use the most effective methods. So instead of relying on condoms, they're more likely to rely on prescription methods. We also know from reports that states have done that these programs tend to be extremely cost-effective. There are states reporting as high as $159 million in cost savings every year. I think the $159 million is Wisconsin, if anybody lives in Wisconsin. It's a huge amount of money. So the research consistently shows that these are effective and that they avert thousands of unintended births. So we started to think, well, what are some possible reasons that we could have seen this? I think one of the possible explanations, and these are all hypotheses, so I will definitely take any other explanations that you might have, is that women do not realize they're aware or eligible for, they're not aware that they are eligible for these programs. These programs are typically designed to grab women who would not typically qualify for Medicaid. So they may not view themselves as being in that eligible for public services window. It may be that they're aware, but for one barrier or another, they're not enrolling in services or accessing them. There's not a ton of data from individual states, but what I could find, in Florida, they say that 9% of eligible women are actually coming to the clinic and receiving services. In North Carolina, they have 14% of women who were eligible enrolled, and of that 14%, 37% received care. So this could indicate very low uptake. It may be very variable across the state, so this may not be representative of the states where you live, but this is what I could find available to me. It may be that women are not consistent in accessing or returning to care. South Carolina, Alabama, and North Carolina all reported out the percentage of women who had received a single service, an initial contraceptive prescription, who returned, and none of those were particularly high. I mean, 76%, I guess, is probably pretty good. But it does indicate that if we've got a low number of women getting in there, and then we're losing additional women afterwards. So this study was the first to look at the population level effect. We didn't find it, but I think it's still an important question, and perhaps there are better methods of trying to answer the question. I think that ideally, while it may be useful to, we know that getting women into care helps. If we could demonstrate that there is an effect on a population level, we may be able to whittle away more quickly at that 3.1 million unintended pregnancies. It may be that because we aggregated states, according to their waiver status. So we took all of the states who had income waivers and grouped them together. And states may be very different in the efficacy and effectiveness of their programs. It may be that when we grouped them together that we just masked all of the differences. Unfortunately, this data set does not allow us to tease out the state level differences. And we simply do not have information on enrollment rates. So it could just be that we have low enrollment. It could be that there's high enrollment in some states and low enrollment in other states, and we've grouped them together that we lost all of that variation. So what I would say our conclusions are is that this study did not produce evidence of a population-level increased contraceptive use associated with the family planning waivers, but that given the overwhelming evidence that women who access these services are doing better with respect to their contraceptive use and avoiding unintended pregnancies, I see no reason we should not continue to pursue this. I do think that this research may speak to needs that I think we're already aware of, needs that we need to continue to increase enrollment. And once women are aware of their eligibility for services, to just reduce barriers to get them there and help them to continue to access services over time.